Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Up North News with Pat Kreitlow starts now.
Well, here we are, and good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense for this Thursday, September 8th. The coffee's ready, so we're good to go. Coming up this morning, Heather Dubois-Borinane of the Wisconsin Public Education Network will tell us about Governor Evers' budget surplus plan and how it might be better to use it on our kids than on corporate tax cuts. Just a crazy thought. Career Newsroom national correspondent Kia Vakil in our 10 a.m. hour. Also ahead, Ron Johnson does it again, a full 180 on same-sex marriage. The news about Tim Michaels' donations to anti-choice groups is worse than you thought. A Waukesha County judge strikes down ballot assistance. A reminder, there is no other developed nation on earth that has an entire political class dedicated to making it harder for its citizens to vote. Also, a membership list has been leaked from the hate group known as the Oath Keepers, and it includes some elected officials and law enforcement in Wisconsin. Check out the winner that we found when asked to defend himself. In that same vein, the New York Times reviews the sordid cast of characters running for Congress around the country and how they could plunge our economy into chaos. And the Obamas return to the White House, and they say a few things about the importance of saving democracy. And the national media calls those remarks political. Sweet Jesus, this is what we've come to. Defending democracy is political. I got to tell you, the news isn't much better over on the sports scene. Brewers lose again to the Rockies and basically go out with a whimper. They go 2-5 on their road trip to Arizona and Colorado. Arizona and Colorado are the two worst teams in the National League West. We can't, I'm going to ask this rhetorically, Luke Mathers, we can't beat the terrible teams.
Is that a question? That sounds more like a statement. That's not even a rhetorical question. That's just a rhetorical statement.
It's not even, I mean, it's the, can somebody add anything to this?
It doesn't make sense because we practically split the season series with the Dodgers, who are the best mm-hmm. team in baseball, and, or one of the best teams in baseball. I haven't looked at current standings at the top because it's a little depressing to take a look at that right now. The Brewers went with, they had, just over a month ago, they had an 80% chance to win the NL Central. Now it's like 0.8%. And that's the stat that I saw yesterday that's just lingering in my head. And I'm like, yep, this stinks. So, like you've attested, the 2022 Brewers are not a bad team. They are not. But they, I believe,
they're performing badly.
Yes. You know,
but they have the talent.
They have the talent, but it's just going to be, I at this point, they'd be lucky to make the playoffs.
Exactly. Eric Lauer went out in the third inning with elbow discomfort. He's going to miss at least one start. And to give you an idea of, you know, what things have been like for Brewers pitching lately, Jace Peterson pitched the eighth inning. That's the seventh time Craig Counsell's put a position player on the mound going, eh, what the hell, you know. And Jace Peterson retired the Rockies in order, 1-2-3 in the eighth inning. So he was able to get it done. Anyway, Brewers flew home, and they have a true doubleheader today. Game one just after 3 o'clock with the San Francisco Giants, which puts game two sometime in the 7 o'clock hour, maybe. And I thought, geez, why, if you're the San Francisco Giants, that's gotta be just brutal to come all the way to Milwaukee for, you know, just the two games in one day. But I see here that they are going to Wrigley for the weekend after that. So not as much of a hardship for them, probably just as brutal on the Brewers having to fly home yesterday after that, you know, slight disaster. I am wondering, there's a number someplace, none of us knows what it is, and we just hope we're farther away from zero than we want to acknowledge. How many nights are left like last night of just perfect sleeping weather? I mean, it was gorgeous. Once again, I woke up way too early, but I couldn't help but notice that it felt nice. It was like, you know, but folks don't really have front porches anymore, much less the screened in kind, but in the neighborhood where I grew up, and a lot of the houses were older, and there were front porches rather than backyards. People didn't have backyards. So front porches, you could actually talk to your neighbors. You got to know your neighbors. And there were times when you would think about sleeping out there on some of those perfect nights. Then you're reminded of mosquitoes and things like that. And I'm not an Eagle Scout like Luke. I can't waterproof, you know, rainproof or bugproof an entire, you know, porch. So I don't do that. But you do end up listening to, you know, the critters that are outside and everything else. And I've become a fan of white noise lately. I've got a, you know, an air purifier, and it doesn't make sense to run it when the windows are open, because, you know, then you're just kind of wasting it. So Luke, fan versus air conditioner at night?
Oh, always windows open fan. Always
fan.
Yeah. Yeah. We're young millennial new homeowners. We don't run that AC unless we're about to be like suffering of heat stroke.
Like, again, the transformation of you into an old man is just really something.
I just said I'm a young millennial homeowner. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I know. With that old man tendency of, you know, we don't. That's gotta be on fire before you need the air conditioner.
It's a 100% my fiance thing. I would turn the AC on in a heartbeat if I could, but she is like, no, 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 we don't need it. And I'm like, all right, I guess I'm just going to sit here and sweat.
Heather Dubois-Bournain from the Wisconsin Public Education Network is coming up after this. You're up north. Thursday morning already on this shortened work week, and happy to be joined now on Up North News with Heather Dubois-Bournain of the Wisconsin Public Education Network. We are going to be discussing a plan put forth by Governor Tony Evers and State Superintendent Jill Underley on one way that you could use that $5 billion state budget surplus, a record high surplus of your money that currently the Republican legislature is just sitting on and hoping to squander it in other ways next year. But Governor Evers has an idea this year for what it could be used for. Heather, glad to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, we know that, again, we're in a campaign season here. So any incumbent governor who puts out something, we understand it's a proposal, it's a policy proposal. It is also meant to tell the voters, look, this is what I would do if I could and if I was reelected. But I know we're not realistically expecting the legislature to come back in session. But if this were another time, another place, and a more reasonable legislature, is it your view that a plan like this should get a fair hearing and a vote?
Oh, absolutely. If it was up to me, the legislature would come back in session today and take up that special session the governor called for so that kids wouldn't have to go back to school this year with $0 in spendable aid in their backpacks. I think one thing that most people don't know, because the narrative on this has been so confusing, is that in the last budget, our state lawmakers actually sent kids back to school with $0 in new spendable aid at a time when needs have never been higher post-pandemic and inflation has never been higher. And so there's been a lot of misinformation, particularly around the state's level of investment and that those federal funds that came in that were one-time funds intended for COVID relief, that have obscured how dire the state funding situation really is and explain why everywhere you look around the state right now, you see districts gearing up to go to referenda.
And I think that it's so important that we clear up that distinction that Republican politicians have really tried to muddy. And there's no shortage of people whose doors get knocked on by legislative candidates. And they're greeted with, well, I heard schools got a record amount of money, you know, in all that pandemic relief, and that's why the legislature, you know, held back. You know, that's the impression that they're under. That's the impression they're hearing. So talk us through the pandemic relief money, what it was supposed to do. And then again, basically the, you know, the paper trick, the math trick that Republicans did with it. But what? Let's start with its original intent.
Well, first of all, those federal funds were intended as immediate one-time aid to address the concerns that schools and teachers and kids had in that pandemic moment. Our state legislature was one of a very few that held up those funds for nearly a year so that they weren't even able to get into our classrooms during that first pandemic year because of the way they wanted them allocated. And so by the time they were finally released, much of the money had already been spent by districts who were scrambling to provide internet access, to provide laptops for kids, to make sure that they have the social distancing in place if they were able to accommodate it in their in face-to-face instruction and so on. And so those needs varied widely by district, and those needs were covered by use of general funds from current aid that wasn't really intended for that purpose. So by the time the federal aids were finally released to public schools, and we are grateful that that aid was substantial and did cover a lot of those costs, there wasn't really this windfall that gave districts a ton of cushion to go into the new year. And so when our Republican lawmakers started suggesting that those funds be used as a substitute for state aid in the last budget cycle, it was not only unrealistic, but just dramatically out of touch with the needs of our kids and the intention of the of that funding.
And you have to ask yourself, are the Republicans who are making these choices to hold these positions and to take these actions, are they that misinformed on how school budgets work, or are they are fully aware of how this all works, but it feeds into a long-range plan to starve public education of necessary funding, whether because you're anti-public school or you're simply a property tax crusader, whichever one or both that you are. I can't ask you, Heather, to read all of their minds, but since you do this for a living, let me put it this way. Those legislators, do they know better? Do they know how the financing system works when they say just use the federal pandemic aid?
You know, I want to give lawmakers the benefit of the doubt that they want to serve well the kids who they do serve in their own districts. But I do think there are a lot of lawmakers who don't fully understand the complexities of that funding system. However, that's no excuse for not doing the right things by our kids. When you sign up to be a state lawmaker, you sign up to close that learning gap for yourself and understand it and get to work in making sure you are providing what you know local kids need. And so that's where we come in. It's up to us to make sure our lawmakers understand the implications of these policy decisions on local kids. It's up to us to vote for people who are going to take that responsibility seriously and who aren't going to use political talking points to trick people into thinking that our schools have everything they need when the opposite is very clearly the case. We are in a funding crisis right now, and we have people bragging about so-called historic investments that are illusory dollars that never actually made it to classrooms.
Heather, you talked about educating legislators, and obviously educating taxpayers is important as well. So that gives us a convenient point to pause and talk about the Wisconsin Public Education Network, what it is, what it's composed of, and your main goals and missions.
Our coalition is basically just people who are volunteering their time all over the state to make sure that local kids have the resources they need to thrive in their local public schools. We are a group of parents and educators and caregivers and school board members and superintendents and community members and business leaders and pretty much everyone in communities who's just sick of the political game playing and ready to call on all of our decision makers to just get on the same page and make some common sense decisions to steer this ship back where it belongs. That we have just experienced decades of deliberate underfunding of our public schools in this state while simultaneously massively expanding private programs that are not held to the same accountability standards as our public schools, diverting resources away from public schools as we do it. And it's just not okay. every year that we don't fix these critical funding problems, we're just investing more money in widening existing gaps instead of closing them like we should. So we're grateful when proposals like the governor's come forward so that we can give some people something concrete to cheer for that we know clearly responds directly to some of the biggest needs that we're seeing in our classrooms right now.
The plan put forth by Governor Evers has many different components to it. And I'd like to take a moment on the special education component and help people understand the reasons why a special education portion of a local school district's budget is high, and yet the state share of that has not been keeping up. And that's where this plan would come in. So yeah, Talk to us a bit about special education and a local school district's budget.
Yeah, has not been keeping up is a dramatic understatement.
Yes.
We have what one national expert called the worst model in the nation for how to fund special ed in this state. We're currently reimbursing our public schools at 30 cents on the dollar. 30% of special education costs, roughly, slightly under that, are reimbursed by the state. The state used to pay upwards of 90%, and the state currently provides that 90% reimbursement to private schools for students who are attending on a special needs voucher. And so we've got an inherent
I'm sorry, Heather, we've got to hit that one again. Did you just say that private voucher schools are still getting the 90% reimbursement for special education costs?
Not only are they getting a statutory 90% of special education cost reimbursement, they are getting the $12,000+ voucher on top of that, which doesn't necessarily even have to be used to accommodate the student's special need per state law. And the public schools are still responsible for providing the special education services for students attending private schools in this state. And so it's an absolute shell game, and people are not aware of how much that funding discrimination is costing our public schools. The things that makes public schools so great is that we accept and embrace all learners. We provide accommodations gladly and willingly to meet the needs of all kids. But when we don't have the resources to do that for some of the students who have the highest needs, then the funding has to come out of our general funds to make sure that that happens. And that's what schools do. We're currently spending more than $1 billion a year, $1 billion with a B, dollars a year, out of general aids, general funds across the state to cover the fact that the state isn't investing in students with disability. It's absolutely shameful. So the governor's proposal closes that gap. It gets us to 90% fairness for both public and private schools by the fourth year, and will make it easier for every single school in the state, not just to meet the needs of students with disabilities, but to free up those much needed funds to be used where they're used, where they're needed elsewhere.
Yeah, forgive me for being redundant, but that makes total sense. If the school district isn't spending 90% anymore, you know, if it's getting 90% rather than 30%, yeah, that's funds that are freed up to do other things as well. Can you tell me a bit about rural school districts? Because I'm reading here about 70% of Wisconsin school districts are considered rural. Is this plan helpful for rural districts in certain ways?
This plan is helpful for every district in the state, because what it does is it does something the last budget didn't do: lifts the spending cap for every single district and provides increased aid to match that raise. That means by the second year, we're looking at $1,000 per student in additional funds. That's about an inflationary increase at today's rates. And it's something that we haven't seen in a couple of budget cycles. So that increase will be transformational for all kids in all districts. And I have only heard applause for that measure, because I think all school leaders know that those funds are desperately needed if we're going to maintain current levels of staffing.
Well, and again, because we have such a large surplus, it enables state government to provide this much needed increase in spending without an increase in property taxes I just, again, I'm not sure why Republicans wouldn't say this is the best possible situation for our kids.
Well, that's really the question. The state has sufficient funds. We can do all of this today without even raising taxes by just using the massive reserves that we have in our surplus and in our rainy day fund if we wanted to. Why don't we? We have the means, we have the plan, we just don't have the political will.
We're going to talk more about that on the other side of the break with Heather Dubois-Bornain of the Wisconsin Public Education Network in just a bit. You're up north.
You're listening to Up North News with Pat Kreitlow.
Up in the morning and out to school.
We are joined on this Thursday morning by Heather Dubois-Bornain from the Wisconsin Public Education Network. You can find them online at wisconsinnetwork.org. And we're going to talk about that in just a sec here. If you've heard things and it spurs you to action, that would be the web address to start to learn about what you can do. We have been talking about a plan by Governor Evers and State Superintendent Jill Underley that would address a record high budget surplus as the Wisconsin economy, you know, comes back from the worst of the pandemic. And of that $5 billion surplus, this plan allocates about $2 billion of that in many different ways to public education so that local property taxes don't have to go up. Sounds like your basic no-brainer, but it's not in the halls and certain corridors of the state capitol. So we were discussing some of the elements of it, Heather, and I wondered if we'll do mental health, and then we've got literacy and financial literacy as well. Tell me about the importance of allocating resources for mental health services in school.
So mental health needs were already a huge unfunded gap in school needs prior to the pandemic. But during and since the pandemic, those needs have really been exacerbated and kind of brought to the fore in a lot of districts and classrooms. And so we are very excited to see that the governor's plan moves away from the past model of providing a limited but welcome pot of aid for this purpose in the form of competitive grants, and provides some finally much needed permanent funding for mental health needs in schools so that our schools can really invest in the staff and resources that's needed to address these issues and make sure that they're hiring the sort of professionals that are required to address those needs in kids, and not just kind of on a token basis, but really to make some substantial difference in the classroom and in the school hallways.
And again, this should resonate with any Republican politician who's trying to claim that schools are in rough shape because they were shut down over the pandemic and it hurt our children. Well, if you believe that our children are in need of greater mental health services, then you maybe should get off your butt and support something like this that provides that kind of permanent assistance to schools. Another typical Republican talking point is schools aren't doing enough to teach the basics, and they're not doing enough to teach financial literacy. And it sounds like Governor Evers and Superintendent Underley are saying, yep, we hear you. How about this? And they've added provisions in the plan for that as well. Tell me the reasons why those are valuable.
You know, this is all just common sense stuff, Pat. It's people who understand what schools need. A governor who used to be the state superintendent of public instruction and the current superintendent of public instruction, who have gone around the state listening, learning, and knowing when they speak to educators, parents, and students what is going on in our classrooms, providing a basic level plan to provide adequate support to those kids. And there's absolutely no reason why we can't do it. This is not a pie in the sky kind of plan. As a matter of fact, this is a first step kind of plan that just catches us up to where we were 2 years ago. Let's not forget, for those who are just joining us, that those kids started school this year at pre-pandemic levels of funding. We didn't even give them an adjustment for inflation the past 2 years and how much their districts can spend. And so the fact that they got some federal aid was helpful, but it was no substitute for the state aid that has been dreadfully inadequate for the past few decades.
And because of that, more school districts than ever have been forced to go to referendum and ask their own taxpayers, parents, retirees, everybody, to raise their own property taxes to make up for what state government in the Republican legislature is, you know, too greedy or too sinister to properly fund. What's the referendum situation looking like for November in this year's elections, Heather?
Well, we're gearing up to see what could be a record number of referenda going to the ballot in a fall election. We're already over 70 referenda questions that have been registered with the state so far. And we know that when you go back to school with a less than budget and uncertainty about what the next 2 to 4 years are going to bring as well, people are worried that if they don't pass those referenda, they aren't going to be able to do things like give teachers a cost of living wage or maintain current levels of staffing or run the kind of programs they know they need for kids to succeed. Last time around, we saw, again, near record passage rates for those referenda when we saw a lot passed in the spring. And we expect to see the same rate of passage this fall, but it's an unsustainable model. We shouldn't have to go to the ballot box and vote to raise taxes on ourselves because the state isn't doing its job in meeting the needs of our kids. It's simply not okay.
And in normal times, it would be enough to insist that the Republican legislature do its job and do the basics of funding the state's share of educating our kids. It is even crazier now that they don't have to do anything but take care of this big old pile of money that's sitting right next to them and send it back out the door in a useful manner. Instead, we've talked about the attitudes of some politicians toward public education. And between that and other reasons why there's more hostility than ever out there, it seems, it is getting really tough to be any kind of an educator, teacher, administrator, and now school board member as well. That, you know, because of the environment at some of these meetings, am I being too hopeful that the atmosphere at a lot of these meetings isn't as bad as it was back when the pandemic was running really hot, but that we're not back to normal yet? Or is that too hopeful an assumption?
You know, it just kind of depends where you look. I think for the most part, people are trying to engage in civic discussion. We love when people show up at school board meetings to share their concerns, whatever those concerns are. But there is a lot of mis and disinformation out there. We're seeing, for example, in some districts, attacks on things like health curricula or reading lists or diversity and inclusion efforts that the district is employing to make sure all students feel valued. And we need to set the record straight on what those efforts really look like in our classrooms and dispel some of the myths and lies that are being spread about what our teachers are doing and trust them to meet the needs of all of our kids. So we're concerned that a lot of those hostilities are being driven by what we know are outside funded, well-orchestrated disinformation campaigns that are easily debunked by looking at what districts really are doing. And we hope that people get the facts and, you know, talk to your educators, talk to your school leaders, talk to your school board members, find out what's really going on in your classrooms and find out how you can support those efforts rather than stand in the way of making sure all kids' needs are met.
And when it comes especially to school districts that are trying to be supportive of kids who are going through some kind of a crisis, there are these controversies that are being manufactured that use words like indoctrination. And Heather, I think what they're losing sight of is that, like it or not, there are more than a couple of instances where for a child, the teacher is the only person they trust to talk to because of what their situation is like at home. That's not indoctrination. That's safety and security of a child at risk.
Our teachers work so hard to apply the professional learning that they have worked hard for and acquired to meet the needs of every student. They can and must be trusted to put those skills to work to make sure that all kids' needs are being met. They are responsible both professionally and morally to make sure that they are meeting the needs of those kids and that they are responding to any concerns that they see or hear. And they're not thinking of themselves as a substitute for parental figures, but it is true that kids trust their educators and that they need trusted adults in their lives. And we know that when we make those great connections with our students, they're much more likely to feel valued, heard, seen, and succeed. And so parents and caregivers all over the state love their public educators because of those connections that they make. Those connections are not a threat to our kids or their public schools. They're what makes our public schools great. And so anyone who wants to characterize those relationships as anything else has another agenda in mind. And that agenda is often dramatically out of line with the intent that we have as a society to make sure our schools are welcoming places for all students. What we're seeing is often those are thinly veiled attacks on things like, you know, LGBTQ plus students, trans students, diversity initiatives that maybe are misunderstood by people who don't understand the value of teaching the truth in all contexts and so on. So let's work to correct those misunderstandings so we can all be on the same page and find out what values we do share.
And if somebody, you know, thinks that something's running afoul of their values at home, start by asking questions rather than just throwing out accusations based on something you heard, you know, on right-wing radio or something like that. So to get back to what you're doing at the Public Education Network, what is it that parents, taxpayers, anybody can do if some of what they've heard here today makes them want to join in and make sure that kids know that and teachers know that they have advocates out there? What would be the first step for somebody that wants to learn more or maybe get involved?
Well, we would love for your first step to be to connect with us. Go to wisconsinnetwork.org, check out our fall lineup of activities. We have got 3 free workshops coming up in the next couple of weeks. One is a school funding 101 session with Dr. Julie Underwood, who is a professor emeritus from UW-Madison and the president of our board of directors. She's going to walk through a higher level understanding of what it is that makes our school funding system work, where it's broken, and what you can do about it. And then the next week, we've got a couple of workshops that are geared toward preparing people to really go into the fall election cycle with the facts, be ready to counter some of the negativity you see or hear at the local level, learn more about what it takes to run a winning referenda campaign or to make sure that people know where the candidates stand on public education issues if you want to be a part of educating voters on that in your community. And we're doing all of this in a very deliberately nonpartisan way without endorsing any candidates for elected office, because we know that voters just want sources they can trust to understand who is going to be a public education champion once I elect them, regardless of what party they represent.
So again, that the homepage is, rather than having to remember Wisconsin Public Education Network, just go to wisconsinnetwork.org, and there somewhere in the middle of the homepage it says Public Education 101. You click on that, it's going to take you right to learning more about how to go to an action page, find out more about the seminars and other things that are going on that they can take part in. And you note that you're, much like they're looking for teachers in schools, you're looking to hire at the network as well.
We are. And you can see what positions we have available at wisconsinnetwork.org. Think about joining Team Public. You can also find out more information about how to get one of these sweet Public Schools Unite Us t-shirts or yard signs for your community and help us spread that positive message to counter the negativity that we're hearing and remind people that it truly is our public schools that bring us together. For better or for worse, we are in community with each other, whether we agree or not on any of the things. And it's our job to model the sort of civic engagement and understanding of what it means to be a productive member of society to our kids. So let's be part of positive change together, and let's make sure that every single voter understands how important this fall election is to public schools, because we need to see that governor's budget proposal passed into law next spring, and we don't want to see it thrown into the garbage like it was last time.
And you said the magic words about civic engagement. I mean, that's the whole reason we started Up North News and now started Civic Media for these fine radio stations, is to increase that level of civic engagement, especially in a world where people think, well, what difference can I make? Or it's so negative out there. It all starts with every one of us. Heather Dubois-Bornain, thank you so much. I really appreciate the visit today.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great day, everybody.
You as well. We'll wrap up this hour's conversation in just a bit. You're Up North. All right, who's ready for some feel-good content? Luke, you ready for things that are more positive, more hopeful in the world?
Let's hear it.
Because I don't want to be accused that our show here is the little black rain cloud of your day. Because, yeah, it's a serious world out there. There are serious issues. We have to remind ourselves now and then to, you know, open up the blinders and see all the good things that are happening. And that is why I continue to be so grateful that we found Christina Lorre, who had been working in TV in Madison, and now as the associate editor of Up North News, one of the things she really wanted to do is build a franchise around the good things that people are doing. So we took the Up in Up North News for a logo, put it next to Lifting. We call it Uplifting, and Christina just finds these little nuggets every day and puts them in our newsletter. You can get our daily newsletter by going to upnorthnewswi.com. Don't forget the WI. And click on newsletter up there in the top banner. And two of the stories that I want to highlight from yesterday's newsletter, one came from Christina, where she noticed that some firefighters in Janesville, especially with Local 580, they posted on their Facebook page about a wonderful encounter with a little guy named DJ outside their local Target store. He was shopping, you know, with his mom, spotted the fire truck, his face lit up. And the crew asked DJ if he wanted a ride, and the crew shared on Facebook that he grabbed his mom and moved with zero hesitation, hopped in the truck, flipped on the lights, gave the air horn a blast, got himself a little badge sticker before leaving with a great big smile. And you'll see in the newsletter that this is one happy looking boy that, you know, just had his day made just by running some errands with mom. And frankly, I think if there were a fire truck parked right outside the radio station right now, Luke, I don't doubt you'd be out there, you know, flipping the dials and ringing the bells and everything like that. Yeah. Maybe putting on a little helmet.
Yeah, my grandfather was a firefighter, so in Milwaukee. So probably.
I think we just need more of the things like that that make some people happy. For me, it would be like, you know, the cart person. I don't want to say the cart girl, but the person who just shows up with a beverage cart, you know, when you're playing golf. I need more of that. Just, it's like the adult version of an ice cream truck. And it's just, you just look out in the driveway and you go, oh, the cart's here, and you can go get yourself a frosty beverage. We need more of those uplifting things.
That would be pretty, that would be pretty uplifting.
That would. Some things are a bit grander, a bit more organized, and that takes me to the other story that's in our newsletter I wanted to share with you right now. And it is about something that happened last month. It happens every year in Appleton, but is getting some national attention now. It's called Appleton's Mile of Music. It's a four-day free festival that is dedicated to independent bands, a lot of them that are getting no financial support. They're not signed to a record label yet or any other kind of representation. They are the original starving artists, if you will. But Appleton has built something around these bands, setting up 40 different venues. 700 different musical sets are played by all the artists that come here. And it started, I want to say 2013, don't have it in front of me right here, but I believe so. Anyway, the Mile of Music Festival is getting some national attention from Rolling Stone magazine. There's an article about it in their September issue. It's also posted on their website, and we have a link to it in our newsletter. The article is titled, How a Wisconsin Music Festival is Making Indie Artists Feel Famous for a Weekend. And it describes how the event has become, quote, the blueprint for how to foster emerging talent. And that really is important when you consider, what is the big thing in music now? in live music. It's the big name VIP acts, VIP seating. The tickets are hundreds of dollars. You know, Ticketmaster and other predators have gobbled them all up and put all these service fees on there. It is just pricey as all get out. And yet in Appleton every August, they find a way to have 700 different musical sets at 40 venues for free. About 80,000 visitors come visit. And here's the twist. When you say, well, what's so different about this? The Appleton community doesn't just say, hey, you know, come on and you can play some music. They make sure that, you know, the artists are paid through underwriting, local sponsors and others who contribute. But they don't just do that. It's not just the financial support. These musicians, through the local businesses that participate, go through a suite of on-site services. They get health screenings, hearing screenings, dental care, massages, physical therapy. They screen for skin cancer. They do professional photo shoots as well as lodging. And one of the artists based out of Nashville told Rolling Stone, you go there and you're famous for a weekend. He said, this is truly a festival for the road dogs, the up-and-coming musicians and bands trying so hard to break through to the next level. Mile of Music reaffirms that you're not crazy, that all the blood and sweat and sacrifice of being an artist is all worth it. And I was not aware of it until one of our newest contributors at Up North News, Kevin Revolinsky. Remember, we talked to him last week about what to do with all the zucchinis and the tomatoes and everything coming out of your garden. Well, that's not his specialty. His specialty is writing about, outdoor recreation. And he also likes to write about music and other events. He was at Mile of Music and he put up a couple of different videos. The one you would expect, it shows you all the different venues. It shows you all the artists that are playing. And it's great. But I was really surprised to see this other video that he put together about what is called artist care. All of these services that are provided to the musicians and others. And one of the singers talks all about it, about the things that she was able to get that she gets nowhere else. And so it's almost like, it's going to become a home base for some of these musicians who, you know, much like a minor league baseball player, just toiling away. So I just thought that was, that's a great, I don't know who came up with the idea, but I think that's wonderful that they would do something like that for these folks.
Yeah, that is a tremendous story, and I was not aware of the Mile of Music, so that is super informative as well, and I'm glad that Up North News can put out information like that to share with Wisconsinites.
Well, and we've talked about music festivals, and of course, by the time we usually talk about it at a certain level in the media, they've become big things, Country Fest and Country Jam and Rock Fest and those are just the ones over here, close to Chippewa Falls. And of course, there's festivals like that all around the state that people hear about. They get the big name acts. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But we can't forget that for, every instance where, again, pardon the baseball analogy, where you're paying $12 for a beer for a $1 million athlete, there's also a ballpark not far away where somebody is still trying to break in, where, the admission is a lot lower, but the game is no less enjoyable. And so it goes with music as well. And the ability to hear what is new, what is emerging, there's no promises that somebody at Mile of Music is going to be the next, big radio star, but it could be, and you'd be able to say that you saw them when they came to Wisconsin and not only put on a great show, but were cared for as well. Well, there's a lot in the news statewide to talk about, so we wanted to get something positive out there because when we come back, Tim Michaels' donations to anti-abortion groups is even worse than you think, and much more, all coming up after our top of the hour break. This is Up North News.